Well, the underlying credit quality, for instance, guy I know, Connor Williams, he's been doing a Substack following Prive, and he noticed, some of the holdings on the private side. There's one with a 10.92% coupon, but was rated BBB, so the bare minimum of investment grade. And just you got to do a sanity check on these things. Like, in what world does an asset rated investment grade yield 10.92%, right? The rest of it is still very similar to an aggregate bond fund. There is a whole lot of investment grade corporates, a lot of agency mortgage-backed securities, and you just gotta ask yourself, like, is it worth paying 70 basis points for this when you can roughly, like, I bet I could probably replicate the risk and return with ag and then probably some CLOs and maybe some floating rate senior loans, and that would probably give me most of the risk and return with half the fees at most.
Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, and this is Inside Is Capital. Joining me on the show today is ETF Portfolio Blueprint founder and owner Tony Dong, who also happens to serve as the lead ETF analyst for ETF Central. He is recognized for his extensive knowledge in ETFs, providing strategic insights and analysis to investors.
This is the Inside Is Capital podcast.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Tony, welcome to the show and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Pierre.
It's great to get this chance to talk to you. Tony, before we get started, tell us about your background and how you got interested in the ETF space in the first place.
Yeah, sure. So I think it all started with my master's degree. I went to Columbia University for risk management. And one of the modules was, or one of the courses dealt with investment risk management. And that's when I got my introduction to ETFs as kind of a very liquid and accessible vehicle for deploying traditionally very complex hedging strategies that were only available to, say, institutional class mutual funds, SMAs, family offices, and the such. And from there, I got really interested in the space. I started writing about it casually just on social media forums like Reddit, eventually got noticed by a few publications and began freelancing around 2021. And from there, I quit my job. I was working full time as the senior risk advisor for a local Canadian Municipal Transportation Authority. It was a decent job, but it just wasn't something I could see myself doing for 30 years. And the rest is history. I've been self-employed for just around 3 years now. I launched my own website about half a year ago.
Right on.
And I continue to be a regular contributor for many publications, notably ETF Central, but also U.S. News and World Report, Money Sense on the Canadian side, Kiplinger on the U.S., previously USA Today, and also The Street.
Interesting. So, Tony, we're in this very tricky, chaotic time right now, which began in and around the confirmation of the Trump election victory. The S&P 500 had been oscillating around the 6,000-point high watermark. And, of course, this week the market rolled over in the wake of the White House's extreme policy makeover, on-again, off-again tariffs. And up until a few weeks ago, the 10-year U.S. Treasury yields, which 10-year U.S. Treasury yield, which peaked at just shy of 4.8%, it's had a visceral risk-off drop in yields down to 4.2. Let's just say it hasn't been an easy time to be an allocator. What are your thoughts on what's happening?
There's not a lot of incentive to take on market risk right now. The S&P 500's earning yield forward is markedly lower than a 10-year yield. And it's just a situation where you are paying so much per dollar of U.S. earnings right now that if multiples just deflate slightly, you could be in for a few years of negative real returns. And just like you mentioned, ever since 2022, allocators have been very skittish about using fixed income as a diversifier. That consistent negative correlation is gone. The monetary policy regime is no longer the same as a decade ago, and fixed income managers like PIMCO, they've ridden that wave to great success with a total return strategy. But I think that really needs to change now. What I'm finding interest in are usually floating rate alternative fixed income assets. So, a lot more interest in higher yielding senior loans that are resistant to rising rates. We're seeing a lot of interest in CLOs as well. With the ETF space really opening up, it's given a lot of opportunity for allocators to finally pun intended, meaningfully allocate to these alternatives in a cost-effective way.
Yeah. So now you recently did an analysis of S&P 500 growth versus S&P 500 value indices, which was very thorough, I would add. And I'm curious, what was your motivation to do that?
Good question. Just seeing the divergence in flows, investors are still piling into growth, even at today's valuations, right? The net year-to-date inflows for the S&P 500 growth ETF from State Street has far outstripped the value side, despite the fact that the former trades at a forward priced earnings of over 40, right? You're paying $40 per a dollar of earning it generates right now. And like investor expectation on the retail side is seemingly believing that the current pace of earnings growth we've seen from the Mag 7 is going to continue in perpetually, which we know is like absurd. But the other thing I noticed is that on the value side, the S&P 500 value isn't exactly that value tilted. I characterize it as more of a large cap core fund with a slight value tilt. And that's the problem that many people pointed out with the first generation S&P 500 style indices is that they take three measures, price to book, price to earnings, and sales to price, and then they just take two ends of it, but neither of it is extreme. So one thing I do want to point out is that S&P has released more quote, sophisticated style indices. They're called a pure value and pure growth, and Invesco has two funds for them, and they're much more concentrated. They offer much more serious exposure to either value or growth than, again, we call them the first generation indices, that more just like a very slight tilt.
It was quite clear in your analysis that the value index, the S&P 500 value index, has really consistently trailed the growth index. For obvious reasons, we don't need to get into why, you know, value's had a really tough time the last 10, 15 years. What's the verdict? What's the verdict on these two choices? Like, you mentioned that, you know, you've been watching the flows, your investors are still tilting heavily towards growth.
I would avoid both of them. I think they're, if you're going to like, how do I put it? If you're going to factor invest, there are better options out there. With active management in the ETF space getting affordable, like you can get a dimensional fund advisors, like actual value ETF for 20 basis points. That is extraordinarily affordable for active management. And the turnover is just as low as an index fund. I think one of the DFA ETFs I like has like a 2% annual turnover, but even then, tax efficiency is so much better than the mutual funds because it can use the ETF creation and redemption in kind. Like my personal suggestion is if you're going to invest in a particular factor, like just go with the established like pros and do it in an ETF. Like these style indices, yes, they're cheap, but you get what you don't pay for, basically.
That's well put. What else did you uncover in your analysis that you think is worth mentioning, in particular with the S&P 500, since they're so popular, they're so widely held? What kind of things you think investors should consider between the two tactics? Obviously, this week, a lot of people are probably thinking, I wish I was in the value tilt. What other insights did you uncover from your analysis?
Asset location matters for tax efficiency for these two. So what I would do is if I was going to hold both of them, I would keep the growth side in a non-tax sheltered account because the 30-day SEC yield is like low. It's low enough that I don't even care about the tax drag, right? And again, as an ETF, it's not spitting out an annual capital gains distribution, right? Some of the actively managed growth funds of the past. The value one has a much higher yield, and that is the one I would keep in a tax sheltered account. So if you're a Canadian allocator, definitely a registered retirement savings plan, because then you don't get dinged 15% off the dividends because, well, it's U.S. domiciled.
For the Canadian, it would be, you know, look to the Canadian domiciled ETFs. For the U.S. investors, obviously, they're not making the choice to invest in Canadian ETFs. But if you had to, as a Canadian investor, if you're going to choose either or any of these options, best to go with the Canadian domiciled option, right?
There's not many in Canada for value versus growth on the U.S. side. Yeah, it's very limited.
Yeah.
And the existing options, they usually use a fund-to-fund structure. The spreads are quite like significantly higher. And also the expense ratios are like multiples of what the U.S. ones are.
Tony, you recently picked up on the thread. You were writing about private markets this year, how private markets have gained a lot of traction. As has the launch of ETFs that give investors the opportunity to get some liquid exposure to what are traditionally illiquid vehicles and markets. There was the launch of two ETFs in particular, ticker PRIV, which is the SPDR SSGA Apollo IG public and private credit ETF. And then also there was the XOVR, ticker XOVR, which is the ER shares private public crossover ETF. These have been among the first. These are controversial. What's the story behind these offerings?
Well, I'll start with XOVR. Yeah. So the concern with that is it's not actually holding direct ownership in SpaceX. It's doing it through what we call an SPV, right? A special purpose vehicle. Normally, you would see that if you were to offer a public fund that holds private assets, you would do so in two ways. The first one is to use a close-ended fund structure where you don't have to worry about creation and redemption. You don't have to worry about flows in or out. But the downside of that is that it can trade at a premium or a discount to its net asset value, depending on demand and supply. We saw that happen with a, I think, DXYZ, which held a numerous bunch of private investments, and it was trading at 1,000% premium to NAV, which was obviously a problem. The other way is that you can use the open-ended structure, but you have it hold an interval fund, which has, you know, periodic openings that you can create and redeem as needed. But again, there are issues with that. XOVR uses an SPV, and there's been concerns raised by various publications, notably Morningstar, about how they mark that position and how often they mark that position, especially because ETF creation and redemption has to be done daily on an ongoing basis. But if you're only marking your SpaceX valuation, say once a month, once a quarter, right, there's questions about how you can guarantee the liquidity and the valuation of those assets. And that's always a concern on the ETF end, especially when in XOVR, it dominates 10% of the position. There's been a lot of discussion about this. I highly recommend looking at David Nadig over at Ronin. He's written a lot about it. Now, PRIV, I don't know how to pronounce it, PRIV from State Street. That's, personally, I don't understand what the need for it is. Like, it's benchmarked against the Bloomberg aggregate, so we know what you're supposed to be, like, substituting it for, your usual aggregate bond allocation. It can have up to 35% in private credit, but 15% of that is capped for actual liquid assets, whereas the rest of it can be shored up through exposure to, say, business development companies like Main Street Capital Corporation or collateralized loan obligations, which are basically pools of privately securitized loans that are bundled together and sold in tranches. At 70 basis points, like, I just want to point out that you can get really good active fixed income management for 70 basis points in the ETF space. There's no shortage of options from, like, top tier managers like PIMCO. So now I'm not really sure where the demand for this ETF is.
Interesting. I mean, it looks like State Street is working with Apollo to capture some of that retail market. What are some of the things that investors should consider risk-wise?
Well, the underlying credit quality. For instance, a guy I know, Connor Williams, he's been doing a Substack following Prive. And he noticed, you know, some of the holdings on the private side, there's one with a 10.92% coupon, but was rated BBB. So the bare minimum of investment grade. And, you know, just, you got to do a sanity check on these things. Like, in what world does an asset rated investment grade yield 10.92%, right? The rest of it is still very similar to an aggregate bond fund. There is a whole lot of investment grade corporates, a lot of agency mortgage-backed securities, and you just got to ask yourself, like, is it worth paying 70 basis points for this when you can roughly, like, I bet I could probably replicate the risk and return with ag, and then probably some CLOs and maybe some floating rate senior loans. And that would probably give me most of the risk in return with half the fees at most.
I mean, is there any reason to believe, like, you know, when you look, we're talking about two huge names here. We're talking about State Street, Apollo, teaming up to sponsor this ETF. They have reputational risk around this. Does that, in your mind, offset at all any of the concern, or is that part of the problem that you see, or Like how do you weigh one against the other? Since the two firms have a longstanding reputation, to what extent does that play any sort of role in offsetting the concerns that you've mentioned?
No, not at all. I'm very much concerned about authority bias in this space. I don't really see a correlation between manager expertise and tenure versus the success of a strategy. Like when I evaluate a fund, yeah, management tenure track record does play a role. But like as far as I'm concerned, each fund, it's its own individual entity with a brand new track record with no history behind it. And, you know, the SEC has actually taken issue with that. They just sent them a letter asking them, like, why are you using Apollo's name on this? Right. They took umbrage with that. And that shows you that, you know, they really want to make sure that these issuers are not, quote, misleading retail investors as to the extent of their sub-advisor's involvement. So actually that ETF, I think the name is going to be changed fairly soon. Correct me if I'm wrong, but as personally, again, just because like Bridgewater, just because Apollo, just because Blackstone is behind something doesn't mean it's an automatic buy for me. Right. You always got to look under the hood for this. And again, like, I don't think Prive is a bad product. I think it's just unnecessary at this point. The use here is, you know, you're an RIA in the U.S. and you need to tell your clients you're allocating to private credit. This is the most liquid and cheap vehicle to do it. But you got to ask yourself, like, what is Apollo scraping off the bottom of their stack to put in this ETF for retail? Right. Is it going to be the best at what they offer to their institutional clients? Who knows? Only time will tell.
Yeah, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, right? Tony, let's talk about what you thought were some of the most notable ETF launches this past year. And we've just talked about the private market ones. Both in the US and Canada, what were some of the more remarkable ones that you saw? And we saw some like 1+1 S&P 500 plus Bitcoin.
I think over on the Canadian side, my two favorite so far have been from Hamilton. You know, they're mostly known for their cover call strategies and stuff. But dude, these two were definitely like breaking the trend for them. Two low cost dividend growth strategies. The US one, SMVP, targets companies with 25 years plus of growth. So very similar to the S&P 500 Dividend Aristocrats. But Hamilton calls them dividend champions because they use Solactive indices. And the Canadian one, CMVP, which is, you know, 6 years of growth because the Canadian market's smaller. I've been very impressed with these so far because, you know, for management fee of 19 basis points undercuts the current options in the Canadian market, that being the Vanguard dividend growth ETF, VGG, which just wraps VIG for 30 basis points. And on the Canadian side, it's super expensive. You have CDZ, which is the iShares Canadian Dividend Aristocrats. That charges 66 basis points, right? Right. Just for a very simple one-dimensional index. So I've been very impressed with these two. I think they're particularly suitable for a core allocation that tilts away from technology. So much heavier weighting towards consumer staples, industrials, healthcare, you know, companies that have managed to increase earnings through multiple economic cycles and maintain their dividend growth streak. On the U.S. side, it's just been crazy. I wake up every morning and it just seems like more and more ETFs have launched. As for what I'm keeping an eye on, I have what I call like an ETF blow up bingo card. And, you know, just a lot of things on there just mostly deal with synthetic options based strategies. So these are what I call derivative onions. And the reason is there is no physical equity in the underlying. It's just all multi-leg option strategies designed to produce ridiculous payoffs. And usually the reference asset is some highly volatile stock like MicroStrategy, Supermicro Computer, Palantir.
Right.
But one of the most interesting ones I'm looking at are ETFs that sell 0 day to expiry options. So we've had cover call ETFs for a long time, but now we actually have ETFs that sell options day to day expiring, you know, at the end of the day, and they just provide overnight exposure. And the rationale behind that is you can capture higher premiums through the rapid theta or the time decay of these zero DTE options. The downside is if the underlying moves against your position, you have much less time to react. You can't really roll out, roll up. But you know, it's very interesting for investors looking for like enhanced income. And most of these also have a managed distribution policy where they're paying on a weekly basis instead of monthly. So retail has been very interested in this. Personally, my opinion is your mileage may vary, right? This isn't something I would use, but there's clearly interest in it.
But clearly a lot of tilt on speculative options.
Oh yeah.
Speculative ETFs launched this year. But what's Tony, what's happening on the other side where you know, okay, we've talked about the private market, but what's happening in the liquid alternative space on the other side where the folks who have benefited from the last 10, 15, 20 years of stock appreciation, bond market appreciation, are looking to preserve capital? What kind of options have come out this past year that are suitable for that objective?
Well, the most recent one just came from State Street again. They're doing a partnership with Bridgewater to bring their famous quote-unquote all-weather strategy to an ETF.
Right.
It uses something very similar to the return stacking we've seen, where they have overlays of derivatives that provide, you know, capital efficiency. So for every dollar you get, say, another dollar layered on. Off the top of my head right now, the notional leverage employed by this ETF is at 171%, and it's split between inflation protected securities, global equities, bonds, and I believe commodities. And it's all done via derivatives. And you know, this is just one of the areas where I just want to stress that, you know, this is not a new concept, right? State Street's getting a lot of fanfare right now because of the Bridgewater name and because of their own brand name. But like, you know, a lot of people in this space, like Rodrigo from Resolve Asset Management, has been doing this with the return stacked ETFs for quite a while to great effect. Even WisdomTree, you know, you might know them for their dividend strategies, but they have a fund called NTSX, which basically gives you 90-60 exposure. It's a 60-40 portfolio, but it uses treasury futures to leverage up the bond side, and 90% of the capital is capped in 500 large cap US equities. So what you really get is a 60-40, which is, you know, in most cases, a fairly efficient portfolio. And you just leverage it up 1.5 times to 90-60. And, you know, aside from years like 2022, it's done quite well compared to 100% equity allocation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. People are running out of space in their portfolios. And this is something that, like, you know, if you're a pension fund officer, you're already familiar with this concept. And I'm glad that more advisors are finally seeing the value in it. I would personally add trend following to that. You know, lots of good ETFs and ETFs now. Yeah. You buy 3-4 of them, diversify manager specific risk. It's more or less a free lunch nowadays.
Were there any other notable launches that stick out? Like the 1+1 S&P 500 plus Bitcoin capital efficiency. What are your thoughts on that? You know, there's obviously a lot of froth about Bitcoin this year. And is that just, you know, trying to take advantage of that trend, or is there something more to it in your mind?
I think Bitcoin is one of the easiest things to allocate to. Just put 2% in IBIT and be done with it. I don't really see the need for this product. It's so volatile that if you overweight in a portfolio north of 5%, the contribution to your portfolio risk is outsized for what it does. And actually, there's a backtest on my website where I demonstrated that a barbell approach, 10% in Bitcoin and 90% in T-bills rebalanced quarterly, would have delivered better risk-adjusted returns than the S&P 500. You don't really need a lot of this stuff, and you don't need it in a managed fund that charges you like a bunch of expense ratios to use Bitcoin futures, right? Right. Some of these don't even actually use spot Bitcoin. And I firmly believe if you're not going to self-custody, use a spot Bitcoin ETF. Like I don't want to own CME Bitcoin futures during a bear market. Like I don't want to deal with the roll yield. I don't want to deal with the potential K-1 or whatever. I don't want to deal with the monthly distributions that's going to be taxable. Like there's just a lot of downsides of not using physical replication. What's on my mind more when it comes to these new options-based strategies are some of the new buffer ETFs we've been seeing. Very big growth in the U.S. side. We've seen a lot of endowments and institutions begin to replace some of their allocation with buffer ETFs because, well, it's a mathematically like guaranteed payoff. And the analogy that I love using for these, it's like riding with a training wheel. And I think it's great for clients in that, you know, if you're going to start your kid riding a bike and they fall immediately and get scared and never ride a bike again, that's the same as somebody who went on an equity heavy allocation, experience their first correction, and then spends the rest of their life sitting in CDs or GICs or something, right? These are great for clients with a low risk tolerance who you're going to say, okay, if you buy this ETF at the start of this outcome period and hold it, the maximum expected loss you can incur is this much. And this is why I strongly believe they're an advisor only tool, because the complexities of deploying them, managing them, overseeing them in a portfolio is a lot of work for a retail investor. Right. And, you know, just just understanding how one of these works from a retail perspective, they use put spreads. So they do something like they'll buy a put at 5% out of the money, and then to finance that, they'll sell another put at 20% out of the money. So that creates your buffer. If the index draws down between 5 and 20, you don't see any of that loss. But after 20%, you continue. But they also need to sell call to finance that. So it's a put spread with a short call layered on top. And, you know, I always tell retail investors to do a sniff check. If you cannot understand the strategy after a thorough read of the prospectus, maybe it's not the best to buy it. You know, don't look at the marketing materials. That's what the firm wants you to see. Right. Read the prospectus.
Interesting. I mean, it's such a, you know, to your point earlier, I completely agree with you. It's a very noisy ETF market. What's your best overall advice? Like, I think one of them might be simplicity, obviously, but what do you advocate for, you know, investors to do in terms of cutting through the confusion and the noise? What do you recommend?
Write an investment policy statement and refer to it whenever the fear of missing out strikes you. So I have one. For instance, my IPS says I'm not going to touch any funds that use derivatives. I know it's just one thing to keep me from getting shiny object syndrome, because I see launches every day that I think are cool. You know, it doesn't mean it's a good idea for me to allocate. So have an investment policy statement that you write in advance during a sound, sane mind. So when everything is launching and everything's going to the moon and you think this new ETF is going to be the next paradigm, dig it out, read it, remind yourself what your past rational self told you you must do, and stick to it. You know, like I have very strict limitations in mind on, you know, what kind of ETFs I can touch. I don't use derivatives. I don't use leverage. I don't touch single stocks aside from a few that pretty much have a double A or triple A credit rating. That's my basis for if I'm going to invest in a single company or not. Like, my number one rule is to not lose money. And just having that distilled in a document, kind of like a personal investment constitution, and being able to go back to that and say, okay, yeah, I know you really want to do this, but read what you wrote like a year ago, follow this. It has been very helpful for me, especially since I'm like bombarded with new launches every day. It gets quite tiresome sometimes.
Yeah, I guess so. That's very sound counsel. I think an investment policy statement makes sense. Having rules set down in advance helps keep the discipline. Tony, one more thing I wanted to ask you about, you know, just to talk about your thoughts on it, because you've written about it. The cockroach portfolio, you recently highlighted it on your site. What is it? Why should investors consider it, or what's in it for investors to consider it? I think it you know, potentially addresses a lot of concerns that investors have about volatility and risk mitigation in the market, as well as obviously the obvious you know, return outlook.
The cockroach portfolio was born out of my attempt to find something for my parents that outperformed the 60-40 and they could stick to and basically just rebalance on their own.
Right.
It's an allocation of just 5 low-cost index ETFs. And on the U.S. side, this portfolio would cost you a weighted average expense ratio of 10 basis points. So it starts with an allocation of 60% equities, but we're not going broad market. We're taking the 3 least cyclical, lowest beta S&P 500 sectors. So that would be the defensive trio of healthcare, consumer staples, and utilities. And the benefit here is all 3 of these have inelastic demand, which means that regardless of economic cycles, you know, consumption and use of utilities, food, medicine stays relatively consistent, which feeds into a less volatile earnings cycle, more consistent earnings growth, dividends, and so forth, right? I'm not concerned with shooting the lights out with returns here. I'm just trying to minimize, you know, year on year fluctuation and those long prolonged drawdowns. And then we have 20%, which is allocated to intermediate term treasuries. And again, this is just, I know a lot of people like to barbell this. A lot of people like to avoid the middle ground. I just want to get exposure to a risk, like a low risk asset, as cheaply as possible. And intermediate treasuries are super easy to do with ETFs. You know, they provide a flight to safety effect. You're not expressing a clear view on interest rates long term, which I don't want to do. I don't want to bet on yields falling or yields rising. So intermediate. And then finally, we have an allocation of gold. And a lot of people don't like it because, well, you know, gold doesn't produce cash flows, is subject to speculation. All I care about is the low correlation to equities and bonds. And I want a third diversifier for years like 2022, where both of those fall in tandem. Right. And so gold does that. Gold has a low correlation to equities, has low correlation to bonds. It doesn't have market risk. It doesn't have credit or interest rate risk. Instead, it's more subject to speculation, central bank buying, geopolitics. Perfect third asset, and you can get it very cheaply with ETFs. And you just put all these together in those proportions, right? 20% in each of those sector ETFs, 20% in gold, 20% in treasuries, rebalance quarterly. And the, you know, the back test I ran here from 1992 to 2025, it's delivered a 8.28 total return with annualized volatility at 9.21 and a Sharpe ratio of 0.65, right? The max drawdown you would have seen during the 2008 financial crisis was 22.16, right? That's half that of the S&P 500, and the 60/40 drew down by 35.97% during this time. So this is just like a very sound allocation that I think is my version of the all-weather portfolio, my version of the Harry Brown permanent portfolio. A lot of those use commodities, they use cash, gold, and it's more or less in risk parity allocation. This is just something you can easily do with five ETFs, leave it to automatically rebalance with new contributions, and just forget about it.
Do you ever feel like people have a hard time believing that it can be that straightforward?
Yeah, I mean, people are constantly being told that you have to be doing something, you know, that you have to be reacting to the news cycle, how you should, like, I see no shortage of articles. And, you know, honestly, I've written a few myself, be like, what should you be thinking about the terrorists, or how can you get defensive? And I always try to end these with it that this is a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah.
Right. If you have a globally diversified portfolio full of equities and fixed income, all you have to be reassured is over the long term, all else being equal, companies will continue to generate more earnings, buy back shares, pay dividends, acquire other companies. Bonds will continue to pay back your interest and principal upon maturity. And regardless of whatever happens, if you have enough of these, even if some fail, you're going to be okay over the long term. And that brings to the point that the rest of it, the staying the course part, is largely psychological. And I think that there's a lot of good studies out there shows that having an advisor here, having someone who knows what they're doing, is in charge of the ship, can help you stay invested. And it's worth, I don't, you know, the 1-2% they charge a year is easily worth that, considering that the average retail investor's money weighted rate of return significantly lags the time weighted rate of return of whatever funds they invest in, because they make all these decisions that jump in and out.
Yeah, that's the classic Dalbar survey. You know, the investments do better than the investors.
Yeah, you know, we see this. Like, we saw it with ARK, where a lot of people bought right at the peak. Even like a longstanding example is Fidelity Magellan. You know, Peter Lynch delivered stellar double-digit returns for a decade, but his investors, the investors who were actually in the fund, consistently did worse.
I think the key, to begin, like where you began, you know, explaining what was the motivation for creating what you call the cockroach portfolio, was that it was for your parents.
Yeah, it's for them to stay invested, you know.
Love it.
Or they can always, the goal is basically that no matter what, if they just want to check their portfolio, if they look at it, they're going to see at least one of the assets is in the green. And if not, I can always point them back to the back test and be like, look, this thing would have tanked 2008, whatever. This time, it's no different.
Yeah.
Right? This thing's been stress tested through the worst recession we've seen so far. And it's done quite well. And, you know, like structurally and economically, it makes sense. I am building this portfolio with an eye on managing risk first. And my whole rationale behind that is the asymmetry of losses. You know, a 10% loss takes 11% to break even, 25, 50, and so on and so forth. And I just want to minimize those deep drawdowns that psychologically the average investor will sell out of in an attempt to preserve value. And that's just, you know, loss aversion, like Daniel Kahneman, loss aversion at play. You know, a lot of people underestimate that, but it is a very strong predictor of when someone's going to panic sell.
Tony, fantastic conversation. Where can folks find you, your sites, your handles?
I am on LinkedIn, so you can just find me by searching Tony Dong. Should be the first result that pops up. Very proud of that. Obviously, my website, etfportfolioblueprint.com. If you're looking for more advisor-focused ETF insights, something more timely, I am the lead ETF analyst for ETF Central, where we profile new launches. One of the recurring series we have is called There's an ETF for That, and it just covers some of the more interesting things you might not have thought about, or maybe you're wondering in the back of your head, like, can I invest in this theme or this strategy? Answer usually is yes, you can. And of course, my other publications on the Canadian side, Money Wise is a big one. I answer a lot of timely reader questions in a monthly column. On the US side, we have the Street US News and World Report, and that's just more of a broad profiling of different funds that comes up. I am not on Twitter. I refuse to use that because it is now a cesspool these days. So unfortunately, no tweets, but I'm very active on LinkedIn, so feel free to connect.
Awesome. Tony, thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and insight. It's been great catching up with you.
My pleasure. Happy to be back anytime.